didn't know what to answer, and the Rebbe was waiting and waiting and waiting. I remember that I blushed. I was not comfortable. I was thinking to myself, you know, can we just move on? Like, can the Rebbe just move on? There were 5,000 eyes gazing at me. I can feel it.
Why did the Rebbe not appoint a successor? And how come the Rebbe never put a stop to the Mashiachist movement?
Somebody once started to sing Yechi in the shul in 770 for Brengen. I just got a call today about a family, actually a Chabad family in Nachlis in Kiryat Malachi. One son was killed in Gaza. This week, a second son lost his life. A second son passed away. So we're talking about a time that is extremely, extremely difficult. And a time when all of us have been mobilized to fight the war of the Jewish people, each one in our own way.
Jewish and Joyful, helping you live a better and happier life.
Hi everybody, it's Aryeh Finger, and welcome back to the Jewish and Joyful podcast. In this week's episode, I had the great honor and privilege to sit with Rabbi Wawa Jacobson. We had hard questions, candid answers, uncensored interview. And be sure to follow our podcast, and our clips are available on all mainstreaming platforms. You can check out our organization page at Torah Anytime, Jewish and Joyful. Please follow and subscribe for more. We're going to talk about Parsha Knowledge, the weekly Torah publication. You can receive Torah thought stories and inspiration on the weekly Parsha. You can email parshanalogy@gmail.com. You can visit parshanalogy.com. And our Arla Mishnah Berurah, we're going to talk about, it's an incredible Hebrew-English Mishnah Berurah. To sponsor an episode, please call 646-397-2320. And now to this week's episode with Rabbi Wawa Jacobson. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Jewish and Joyful podcast. It's a great honor and privilege to have Rabbi Wawa Jacobson. Rabbi Wawa, please start off by telling us a bit about yourself, about your background.
I was born in Brooklyn, New York. In the year Tafshin Lamed Beis, 1972, my parents both came from the Soviet Union. They grew up in communist Russia under the dictatorship and tyranny of Joseph Stalin. Both of their families suffered tremendously in the communist regime, but they were saved from Hitler and ultimately made it out of Russia after the Second World War. With false passports, they came to what's called the DP camps. And from there, they ultimately made their way to the other side of the ocean. My father came to Canada. My mother came to New York. And we grew up in Brooklyn. My father was a journalist for most of his life. He served as the correspondent of the largest Israeli newspaper. It's a daily Israeli newspaper, a secular newspaper called Yediot Ahronot. And he was its correspondent in New York and the United Nations. He also worked for other newspapers and journals. So I grew up in the home of a journalist. I also had the privilege of growing up at the feet of the Lubavitcher Rebbe of blessed memory in Crown Heights. And that's where I studied. That's where I learned. And for the last, I would say, 25 years or so, a little more, I really had the privilege of traveling and visiting, I guess, hundreds of communities, schools, yeshivas, shuls, Jewish centers, speaking to audiences from all backgrounds and walks of life, even non-Jewish audiences, and trying to be a ambassador for love and for truth and for joy and for authenticity and for Torah and for Yiddishkeit. So that's a little bit about me.
What would you say made you the powerful, influential, and popular rabbi? Of course, you had the Shemaya, but which aspects of it made you so great?
Well, let's have... you stated a premise about popularity and influence, and then you're asking me what happened that way, what made it that way. I don't know that that premise is at all accurate. What I will say is that... Over the years, I've had the privilege, with Hashem's grace, and as you said, Sayata Deshmaya, I think to be able to serve as a channel for inspiration and for empowerment to many, many people. And probably one of the greatest things I would attribute that to is, number one, the Rebbe I grew up with, As I said, I grew up at the feet of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and his holiness and his wisdom and his truthfulness and his Avas Hashem, Avas HaTorah, Avas Yisrael have affected me very deeply. And today I have the schus to serve as a channel for that wisdom. That's number one. And number two, I try to share with people not just words, but I try to share with people who I am. In other words, not just preach words and messages, but really share from inside. I think number three, I try to speak to people's real struggles, to their authentic selves, not just to an imaginary idea that may be abstract, but to really speak to people's hearts and souls where they are today. And I also always feel that it's important to make Yiddishkeit and Torah extremely relevant, that people should be able to feel it in their bones, have a visceral experience of Emunah, understand Yiddishkeit and Torah and mitzvahs, not just as something nice or even holy, of course that too, but to be able to really see how it can touch them in their own deepest neshama, in their own deepest mind, and in their own deepest heart. And I'd say finally, maybe one more thing I think speaks to a lot of people is, you asked me a deep question, so that's why I'm being reflective. I think very often we have a challenge in making space for the strugglers among us, as though they're like different. When really I see that all of Yiddishkeit is really about creating space for all the struggles inside of us, and then we could create space for the struggles inside other people. I think very often a lot of people feel that if they're struggling, somehow they have to hide it, they have to go undercover, there's no place for it in our world. And I think a lot of my messages really help people understand that life is all about finding the light within the darkness, finding the truth within the falsehood, and finding godliness within all parts of the self and of the universe. Those are some things that I think speak to a lot of people. Not everybody, but to a lot of people.
So going back to your relationship with Baba Tereba, what was your relationship like when you were a young boy?
So my relationship with the Rebbe wasn't personal on that level that I would go in and speak to him. Those days, when I was growing up in the 70s and the 80s, the Lubavitcher Rebbe already had there was so many people there. I mean, there were tens of thousands of people, hundreds of thousands of people that would come. Just the amount of letters. I mean, he would get hundreds of letters every single day. So I didn't have an ability, you know, to go into the room, and Shmuel was on that level. But I grew up in his Dalet Amos, in his four cubits, and I would attend all of his sichas, his talks, his addresses, his maimarim, his fabrengens. And in the later years, the Rebbe's last years and my early years, my formative years, I had the great merit of joining the group of Chayzrim. Chayzrim is the word for oral scribes. The Rebbe would speak for many hours, but most of the times it was on Shabbos and Yom Tov. So there were no recording devices, of course. Everything had to be memorized. So there was a small group of Talmidei Chachamim whose job it was to memorize the Rebbe's talks, the Sichas, his Maimarim, because they were very, very deep and intricate and long. This wasn't a 15-minute Dvar Torah or 15-minute Vart. You're talking about Fabrengens of the Rebbe that can go for 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours. And this is not an exaggeration. 3 hours was very, very often, and then it would go for more. And the Rebbe's talks were very, very deep, meaning with a joke and another joke and a story, another story. You're talking about there were Siyumim and Hadronim and Pilpulim, Nigla, Halacha, Pilpul, Gemara, Shas, Paiskim, Rishonim, Achronim, Kabbalah, Machshava, Ashkof, Echsidus. And each talk can be an hour and a half an hour. So there was a small group of Talmidei Chachamim whose job it was to memorize and then transcribe. So in the last years, I had the privilege of being on that team. And we would write up the Rebbe's talks very often. He would edit them. So I had that connection with the Rebbe. And I would say that a lot of my Weltanschauung, my Hashkafas Olam, my identity as a human being, as a Jew, especially in the approach to Torah, how to learn and how to teach, I received a lot of it from the Rebbe.
So what was your story as a young boy by one of the big Mamorim with when the Rebbe pointed to you or something?
The story is that I was a young boy and it was the middle of a Fabrengen. And Fabrengen is the word in Yiddish for gathering. It's the Hasidic term, especially in Chabad, when Hasidim and students would come together and sing and inspire themselves. But the Rebbe Fabrengen was more like a shir. But it wasn't one shir, it could be like eight shir, because each sikha, each talk was another shir. So one shir could be in the Rashi on the Parsha, another shir could be on the Zohar in the Parsha, another shir could be on a Rambam, another shir could be a Siyum on a Masechta or a Sugya in Shas, or another shir on Chinuch or Hashkafa. So like one Fabrein can have eight or seven or six shir. And you're talking about a long shir. And the shirim were very, very, very deep and intricate. And once the Rebbe was giving such a shir, it was a Rashi. The Rebbe developed a shit in how to learn Rashi on Chumash, a whole fascinating shit over 25, 30 years. And every Shabbos, he would dedicate, could be a half an hour, 2 hours, to learn a Rashi on the Parsha with tremendous depth. He was medayik in every word of Rashi, and he showed sometimes unbelievable perspectives on how to see Rashi, how to understand Rashi, how Rashi wrote his Pirush, Rashi's Shitta. So the Rebbe was talking about one of the Rashi sechas. I think it was Shabbos Parshas Vayakel Pekude, or maybe Shabbos Vayikra, that time before Pesach. The truth is, I was a little kid. I wasn't concentrating on what he was saying. I was daydreaming. And the Rebbe was talking about Moshe and Aaron, the difference of Moshe and Aaron, according to Pshat, Remez, Drush, Sod. In the middle, I see a finger pointing at me. If the Rebbe was sitting in his place where he sat, I would stand mamish parallel to him, like against him straight. If you make a straight line, I was there as a kid. For many years, I stood there as a child, a little kid. And I see the Rebbe, who was already an older man, so his finger was shaking a little bit. His finger goes up. That was very uncommon, because the Rebbe would hold his hands under the table the whole time. You could see that he was moving his hands because the tablecloth would jump up and down. But he always held his hands under the table. They would not come out. That's how he would talk. Sit at the edge of a chair and his hands on the table, and suddenly I see his hand coming up, his finger like this, mamish, and he extends his hand and he's pointing, and like everybody, maybe 5,000 men in the room besides the women in the women's section, and everybody's turning, like including me, like what's next? This was not a common thing. The Rebbe wouldn't talk or engage with people during his sichas. It was very, very rare that in the middle of a sichah you should turn to somebody. I mean, it was almost not never, but it was almost never. And it's like, OMG, I think that's me. You know, first it was, you know, who's behind? Who's the guy behind me, right? Like, I was certain it was not me. It was maybe some guest, some interesting person that everyone wants to speak to. I was a kid then. I was there for years. I grew up there. But I see that finger is pointing right at me. And the place was stunned. Everybody was looking at this person whom the Rebbe was addressing, and I still recall he smiled and he asked me a question in Yiddish as he was pointing like this. His finger was shaking a little bit, and he said to me, "Von wann weißt du, dass die Welt?" How do you know that the world exists? How do you know that there is a world, that there is a universe? Truth be told, I did not know where that's coming from. How do I know the world exists? How does anybody know the world exists? I never thought about how I knew the world exists. I really never thought about it. I was a young child, and I wasn't thinking about these types of things. But this was the discussion that Rebbe was having earlier in the talk. I didn't know what the Rebbe was talking about because I was daydreaming. I was doing something else. I didn't know what to answer. And the Rebbe was waiting and waiting and waiting. I remember that I blushed. I was not comfortable. I was thinking to myself, you know, can we just move on? Like, can the Rebbe just move on? There were 5,000 eyes gazing at me. I can feel it. And the Rebbe just waited. It was maybe, I don't know, 10 seconds, 15 seconds. To me, it seemed like eternity. And I didn't answer. I didn't know what to answer. I was also a shy boy. I didn't have what to answer, and I didn't know what to answer. So the Rebbe waited and waited, and he smiled. And then the Rebbe decided to answer the question for me. Instead of me answering, he answered, as so to speak, as my representative. The Rebbe said, Entveter, the child answers, how do I know the universe exists? Because the opening pasuk of the whole Torah in the beginning of Parshas Bereishis states, Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim ve'es ha-aretz. In the beginning, Hashem created the heaven and the earth. That's how he knows that the universe exists, because it says in Torah, Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim ve'es ha-aretz. If it says in Torah, it got to be true. And then he went on to continue the discussion. I remember next week I was afraid he's going to ask me another question. So I started to listen. And ultimately, I became one of the people who was writing down those talks. As I grew up a little bit and I went back, I always remember this, I went back to the talk and I saw that the Rebbe was really addressing the purity of children. He was talking about the difference of Moshe and Aaron, that Moshe was Moshe Emes v'Terasi Emes. Moshe's whole Metzias, his whole reality was Torah. Aaron was Oyeves Habrius. Aaron was involved with people. Aaron dealt with people and conflicts and shalom bayis. And Aaron was much more enmeshed in the struggles of people. And therefore, it says in Medrash that Moshe is Emes and Aaron is Chesed. So the Rebbe was explaining that youngsters, children, especially who are learning Torah all day, they have that ability to see the world from a very, very pure and innocent place. So when you ask them how they know the world exists, it's not from the newspapers, it's not from the outside. It's all from Torah, but H is Bara Lekim is Hashemayim Vesaretz. Today, when I ask myself why the Rebbe asked me the question to a lot of people in shul, I don't know the answer, but perhaps one of the messages, at least that I took from it out of it, is that the most powerful source, the most powerful message that I and we can give to other people and to ourselves is to be able to teach people the world from the perspective of Bereishis bara Elokim es ha-shamayim ve'es ha-aretz.
So before we start talking about joyful and how to get through challenging times being besimcha, just while we're on this topic, I want to ask you, first of all, our family has great respect for the Lubavitcher Rebbe. However, there are some things that are bothering some people, and perhaps you can elaborate on this and clarify. First question was, why did the Rebbe not appoint a successor? And how come the Rebbe never put a stop to the Mashiachist movement? So if you could please clarify on that, because it's bothering a lot of people and we want to hear the answer.
Great question. Why the Rebbe didn't appoint a successor? I don't feel I'm in a position to answer such a question. You know, I don't have the authority and the type of knowledge to be able to know what was going on in the Rebbe's mind.
Right.
I can't answer the question. All I can suggest is it could be that the Rebbe didn't feel that he had a successor. Sometimes in life, you know, you just have to rely on Hashem, like realize that Hashem has a plan, and we have to respect that plan. Like, you know, even the greatest of people, you know, we're all Avdei Hashem, we're servants of Hashem. The Rebbe didn't have children. His father-in-law, who he succeeded, had three daughters. One was killed in the Holocaust, and there were two daughters left, two sons-in-law. The Rebbe, the middle son-in-law, became the Rebbe. But the Rebbe didn't have biologically any children. And it could be that he didn't feel that he has a successor to appoint. So what was he supposed to do? You know, he gave everything he gave. He hoped and prayed and craved and yearned that Mashiach would come in his lifetime. But it could be he didn't feel that he has somebody to appoint. It's interesting, though. I just remembered as you asked me the question. There was a Fabrengen of the Rebbe, Yud Gimel Nissen, Tavshin Chavav. Before Pesach, 1966, is the Yartzeit of the Tzemach Tzedek. I don't know if you know the Tzemach Tzedek. Tzemach Tzedek was the Rebbe's great-great-grandfather. He was a grandson of the Baal HaTanya, the third Lubavitcher Rebbe. The Rebbe was the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe. Tzemach Tzedek, whom the Rebbe was named after, Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Lubavitch, the Tzemach Tzedek, he was one of the great poskim of his dair, the Goyne HaDair. He was a grandson of the Baal HaTanya, the third Chabad Rebbe. So his yartzeit is Yud Gimel Nissen. He passed away Tofresh Chavav, which is 1866. So at the 100th anniversary, it was 1966. So the Rebbe had a Fabrengen. And he told a story that when the Tzemach Tzedek was in Petersburg with Reb Itchel of Alozhiner, many other Gdolim, they were trying to fight the Haskalah movement and the changes in Chinuch. And anyway, the Tzemach Tzedek got arrested 22 times in Petersburg because of his Mesiris Nefesh for Chinuch. 22 times they arrested him. And one of the Gedolei Yisrael, I think it was Reb Itchel of Alajna, was a son of Reb Chaim of Alajna, who was a student of the Vilna Gaon. Reb Itchel of Alajna and Tzemach Tzedek worked very closely together. Generally, in that generation already, there was a much more peace between the different groups within the Orthodox world, the Chassidim, the Misnagdim. Tzemach Tzedek worked very closely with a lot of the great Lithuanian leaders, as did the later Chabad Rebbes, the Rebbe Rashab, and Reb Chaim Brisker, and the Chafetz Chaim, and Reb Chaim Oizer. The relationship was magnificent. So one of the Gedolei Yisrael, I think it was Reb Itchel, I don't know if the Rebbe said the name, but he told the story. So asked Tzemach Tzedek, you're going to be arrested. And they could take you away. They can kill you. They can exile you. The Tzemach Tzedek had tens of thousands of Hasidim. Throughout Russia, there were hundreds of thousands of Jews that were connected to him in some way or another. So he said, how can you do this? What are you going to do with all your disciples, all your students, all your Hasidim? So the Tzemach Tzedek said, in Gemara, we have an answer, and then v'yibayisem, a second answer. So he said, I'll do the same thing. I'll give you an answer, and then v'yibayisem. He said, the first answer is, I have children. Tzemach Tzedek had many children. He had seven sons, I have children. And the second answer, v'yibayisem, he said, the achdus von chassidim v'tzeihalten biz Mashiach. The unity of the chassidim will hold them until Mashiach's coming. Wow. This is what the Tzemach Tzedek answered. So listen to this. 100 years later, the Rebbe said over the story. Then he said these words. He said that now the first answer is not applicable anymore, but we still have the second answer. You understand? First answer is not applicable anymore because the Rebbe didn't have children.
Right. The Achdus.
Let's have the second answer, that the unity of Yidden and their dedication and commitment to Torah and Mitzvahs and to Chassidus will hold them till Bias HaMashiach. That's what he said publicly out of Habrein. So that's really the best answer I can give in any genuine and serious way. In terms of the whole Mashiach issue, the Rebbe was not, I mean, I heard myself, somebody once started to sing Yechi in the shul in 770 out of Habrein. And the Rebbe said then that I should really leave. When I hear this, I should really leave. But the reason I'm not leaving is, first of all, I'm not sure it's going to help. And second of all, if I leave, everybody's going to leave. And the Matoiv Manoyim Sheves Achim Yam Yachad is going to be obliterated. It was very clear. The Rebbe a few times expressed himself quite emphatically that the obsession with promoting him as Mashiach is counterproductive. And in fact, there were times that he spoke very, very, very sharply. I saw it and I heard it myself, and it was clear. But I think there's also another side to it. Another side to it is, and this is important to understand, I heard this from Rabbi Breidowitz, Rabbi Avram Breidowitz from Baltimore, Maryland, and then today's one of the Rashivas of Har Sameach. I heard this from him, and he said, you know, that... He said, for somebody to say that it's kfira, it's against Amuna to believe that the Rebbe was potentially Mashiach, he says is ridiculous. He says it's not true. Every generation, Chassam Sofer says, if Mashiach could come any day, that means in every generation there has to be somebody who's a potential Mashiach. We say Achakaloi b'chol yom sheyava, right? That means today Mashiach can come. Another 20 years ago, 30 years ago, every day a Jew believes Mashiach comes today. Every single day. So the Chassam Sofer writes, also the Chassam Sofer, that in every generation there is a potential Mashiach, that if Hashem wants, he will choose him to be Mashiach. Someone Melech Meis David. Breidowitz said, and in fact, the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Daf Tzadik Ches, that many students would say that their Rebbe is Mashiach. The Gemara says that the students of Reb Yanai said, Yanai, his name is Yanai. The students of Hananya said, the Gemara goes through a whole list, the Beis Shiloh, they said, Shiloh Shmai, the Rashi says that the Talmidim used to say that Mashiach is the same name like their Rebbe. That's what the Gemara says over there. So to say that somebody who believes that his Rebbe is Mashiach, especially somebody with such qualifications, to say that that's against Torah, that's not fair. I don't think it's true. I think Rabbi Breidowitz is right about that. So you could say, I don't agree, I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it's wise, right? It can be misconstrued. It can be misunderstood. That's all fair. But to say that it's against Yiddishkeit, it's against Torah, to believe that someone has the potential to be Mashiach if he fits the qualifications of Halacha and Torah, I don't think that's fair. So the Rebbe was also very careful in that. The Rebbe spoke about it a few times, but the Rebbe could not tell people, right, that they're not allowed to believe something that is not against Torah. On the contrary, you know, the Rebbe himself, I feel, it was clear from him that he felt that his father-in-law was potential Mashiach, the Rebbe Rayatz. You know, there were many Chassidim used to say it on their Rebbes, right? The Eirach Chaim writes, Ushmoy Chaim. I mean, you have over the generations, in the Litvisha world, in the Chassidisha world, where people felt that their Rebbe had the potential to be Mashiach. I also heard from Rabbi Breidowitz, I can't confirm this, that somebody once came into Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, one of the great Poiskim of the Poiski Hadar, the Baal Igris Moshe. This is what I heard from him. And said to him, you hear people are saying that the Lubavitcher Rebbe is Mashiach. I guess the person was very upset. Rabbi Breidowitz said, Rabbi Moshe looked at him and said, so what? Halavai. Halavai. Yeah. So what? So they're saying, Halavai. Let Mashiach come and then we'll see who's Mashiach. So I think, you know, it's the Rebbe once wrote a letter to somebody. I saw the answer. He wrote to him. There is no obligation whatsoever to search who is Mashiach. Ein chiyuv klal lechapas miyum Mashiach. There is an obligation of ahavta l'reicha kamoicha, to love every Jew like we love ourselves. So the question of Mashiach's identity is a very sensitive one. If somebody is following halacha and shulchan aruch, I don't have to agree, but I wouldn't condemn it. If somebody is violating shulchan aruch, we have to condemn it. If somebody is saying something that's not inconsistent with halacha, one can't condemn it. There's a lot of different minhagim and a lot of different shittas, a lot of different ashkafas, as long we follow the halacha, all of us. That's what binds us as Jews. If a Jew follows halacha, I can't condemn it, even if I don't agree with it. But I think we always have to be careful not to live in a situation where chas v'shalom, we hate each other and we mistrust each other and we are fragmented with each other. And the truth is, in Chabad itself, they had a split about this. They had a lot of arguments about this in Lubavitch. It's very well known, right? There's still some arguments going on. Today it's much less, but there's still arguments going on. And they had to deal with it, you know, within their movement because there were different perspectives and different shittas. But I think that the most important message I got from the Rebbe is that we are living in the generation of Geula before Mashiach's coming. And our greatest responsibility today is to do everything to unite the Jewish people, to live in a place of achdus, do everything to be machzer b'tshuva the Jewish people, to do everything to promote love and light and Yiddishkeit among all of our brothers and sisters and prepare Klal Yisrael and the world for Bias HaMashiach. So I think it's very, very important, especially for those who feel themselves to be students of the Rebbe, not to allow ourselves to be Mesiach Das and to deviate at all from the main mission of our generation, which is L'sakin Oyla B'malchus Shindaligyu, to fill our lives in the world with truth, with authenticity, with Einoid Mulvadai, and with the light of the Geula, which is the light of Emunah and the light of Achdus and the light of Torah.
And if I may ask, what about the Messianic movement that's going on now, these days, the little that's going on?
Yeah, listen, there are those who call themselves Chabad Hasidim, and some of them are very, very loud. So there is a small fringe group of people who say things that are very, very irresponsible and are very, very misguided. I know some of them, and I have to say that some of them have emotional challenges. You have to realize that. Some of them have emotional challenges. And Chabad has a tremendous mila, but it comes with a price. Mila is, it's very, very democratic, which means Chabad is not a community. It's a movement. You know the difference between a kehillah and a movement. A community, there's a community, there's a rabbi, there's a rebbe, there's a rosh yeshiva. This is how you dress. This is how you speak. This is how you behave. You're in or you're out. So people think Chabad is that way. It's like a community with a unified leadership. It doesn't, Chabad is a movement. It spans the globe. Hundreds and thousands of Jews, probably today millions of Jews connected to Chabad. If you include everyone who goes to Chabad houses, Chabad camps, Chabad schools, Chabad shuls, right? From one extreme to another, you have Chabad of Sydney, you have Chabad of Moscow, right? You have Chabad of Melbourne, you have Chabad of Hawaii, Chabad of Las Vegas, and Chabad of Mexico, and Chabad of Alaska, wow. And Los Angeles and Peru. Now, even though they're all connected because they get their inspiration from Yiddishkeit and from Chabad Chassidus and from the Rebbe. But it's manifested in so many different ways and styles and Nuschayis and Mahalchim and Chalois. It's just very, very, very diverse. You're talking about a world movement, not a community. Because of that, there's also so much diversity and so many different types of people. And you sometimes have people who are very, very loud and sometimes do things in a very, very irresponsible way and say things that are either foolish or ludicrous or absurd. And they don't have at the moment, you know, that unified leadership that controls things in a very, very powerful way. But I think that the immune system of Chabad is more healthy than many people imagine because it has the immune system of Shulchan Aruch and of the Baal Shem Tov and of the Alter Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, and of the Rebbe. And these were people that their entire life was a story of Mesiris Nefesh and Emunah. So I think ultimately the truth of the Alter Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, the Rebbe, the Baal Shem Tov, Shulchan Aruch, it spits out anything that is not consistent with Torah and with Yerushalayim and with Chassidus. Sometimes it takes time, sometimes it's painful. But anything that's not consistent with normalcy and with halacha and with chassidus and with the Alter Rebbe and the Rebbe wanted, ultimately, there's no place for it in Chabad. Because Chabad is a movement that its entire metzias is mesiris nefesh for Hashem and for Avos Hashem and Avos HaTed and Avos Yisrael.
Amazing.
And I'm trying to be very authentic, very, very authentic and very real, you know. I knew the Rebbe. I saw the Rebbe for many years. I know what Lubavitch is at its core. I know what Chabad is at its core. And I'll tell you something. The Rebbe had to make this decision. He decentralized Chabad. He did not control it like a community. He did not. And there was a reason. I think one of the reasons for it is because it allows people and gives them creativity that is unprecedented. If the Rebbe would have controlled Chabad, everybody would just be working in a very, very limited fashion. The Rebbe told people, go out, take over the world, build, create, build communities, build schools, build movements, build websites, build hashpa, build askadis, build physically, spiritually. So every shliach, every rabbi goes out, it's his baby, he's working for himself. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's his balabatim, it's his baby. So it created unprecedented growth. I think the Rebbe also understood. Lubav Chabad is the fastest growing movement in Judaism.
Wow.
And after the Rebbe passed away, Chabad didn't double, didn't triple, it quadrupled.
Mm-hmm.
It quadrupled, more than quadrupled. How'd that happen? It happened because the Rebbe's entire approach was to empower people to take responsibility. It's not about me, it's about you. You take responsibility, you take initiative. Because of that, his whole derech of mentorship was to give people a lot of power. Much more than you'll see in other places.
Yeah.
It comes with a price. You know the price it comes with. Yeah. It comes with a price that sometimes people get out of hand and they do their own thing and you don't have this tight control. You don't have this tight control in Lubavitch.
Mm.
But on the other hand, it's really like Orthodox Judaism. What gave the koyach of Orthodox Judaism to survive after thousands of years and not be diluted? The answer is because the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is the immune system of the Jewish people. When somebody ultimately rebels against Shulchan Aruch, even if they have 1,000 excuses, you know, the Shapsi Tzvis of the world, the Tzdukim, the Krayim, the Reformers, the system spits them out. It may take 50 years, the system spits them out. Because there's a Shulchan Aruch, and Shulchan Aruch is documented. This is the Messiah of Torah, Shepiksam, and Torah Shabbat. The same is true with any authentic Jewish movement. The immune system that the Alter Rebbe, the Baal HaTanya, and the Rebbe, and all the Rebbes in between established is so powerful that ultimately any deviation from clear halacha and Yerushalayim And the Yesodus of Torah and Chassidus that the Baal Shem Tov, the Baal HaTanya, the Rebbe established, ultimately will, Chabad is allergic to it, and it will not be able to survive. Its sick cells will not be able to survive in the organism of Chabad Chassidus.
A lot of people want Divrei Torah for the Shabbos table. They want something short and sweet, not too long, but fits good for the family, the older people, the under people, and they're stuck a lot of time. So what's good? Well, I tell you about Parsha Knowledge. It's a weekly Torah publication with the Torah thought story with the amazing inspiration on the weekly Parsha. Short and sweet to the point. Hopefully it'll be what you're looking for. And it's free. You can subscribe. You can email parshaknowledge@gmail.com or you can visit the website parshaknowledge.com.
Okay, so we're now in the month of Adar, and it says, Mishnechas Adar Marbim B'Simcha. So we know this Vasemes, I think the Vasemes says that this proves that during the year you have to be happy, and Adar you have to be even more happy. So especially now with all the crazy things going on in the world, it's very challenging times. How do we balance happiness and pain? Because we hear about Rahman al-Tzlan, the soldiers that are dying, the hostages, and we feel very sad, and some people get depressed, but we also have to be happy. We have to have simcha. So how do you balance the two factors of being happy and the pain going on?
Well, very, very powerful question about Arye. I'll tell you how I see it. At least one aspect of how I see it. What does simcha really mean? Simcha, joy in Yiddishkeit, I don't think it means, you know, that everything is bliss and beautiful and perfect and I'm living in la-la land and life is rosy. We're living in a time where the Jewish people are being challenged to their core. Klal Yisrael is at war. Thousands and thousands and thousands of families in the Holy Land have been affected in ways that are unfathomable. I just got a call today about a family, actually a Chabad family in Nachlis, in Kiryat Malachi. One son was killed in Gaza. This week, a second son lost his life. A second son passed away. So we're talking about a time that is extremely, extremely difficult. And a time when all of us have been mobilized to fight the war of the Jewish people, each one in our own way. What does simcha then mean? What simcha, I think, means is, it means the conviction and the knowledge of knowing what is my job at this time, and knowing that I'm in the right time, I'm in the right place, and I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing now. Simcha is the deep sense of satisfaction and conviction and awareness that I am showing up the way I'm supposed to show up, with my authenticity, with my sincerity, with my love, with my light, with my energy. It's that conviction and that knowledge of showing up and knowing that I am ready to fulfill the mission that is asked of me to fulfill at this moment. That creates a sense of belonging, of connectivity, of authenticity, of knowing I am who I'm supposed to be, and I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. That's what one level of simcha is.
What makes a happy and successful person, and what's the true key to a happy life?
Wow, what a big question. What gives a person happiness, and what's the key to a happy and successful life? That's a very, very big question. It's probably... We could sit on this for a few years, maybe a few decades, maybe a few lifetimes. But one thought that comes to mind, I didn't prepare for this, so just one thought that comes to mind is, I think simcha is very much connected with integration. When we can integrate all the parts of ourselves into a seamless whole. If you really want, it's in the pasuk, a very famous pasuk, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Which means, as the great, great spiritual masters, especially the Shalah, the Baal Shem Tov, explain, based on Kabbalah, Machshava, that Hashem Echad doesn't only mean there's one God and not a thousand gods. True. Hashem Echad also means that Hashem is oneness. Hashem is oneness. Hashem Einoid Molvaday. Everything is part of that one. And I think when we achieve that in our life, when we can integrate all the parts of ourselves and see them as a mosaic, as a tapestry, as part of a unified piece of art, as a note in the cosmic divine symphony. That is what simcha is. That is what I think at least one major part of joy. And what that means practically in a person's life is, you know, we have different voices, we have different emotions, we have different experiences, different habits and instincts, and different inner visceral triggers and responses based on the day, based on the people we're with, based on the circumstances, based on the space that we're in. And so many things can derail us and plunge us into a space of anger, despair, wackiness, unpredictability. I'm overwhelmed. I'm sad. I'm resentful. And we go down those rabbit holes so easily. And I think simcha is when we're anchored in a place of essence, when we're anchored in a place of oneness, and then from there we can watch all of our parts and ultimately bring a certain sense of purpose and unity and meaning and divinity to all of them. And then when I'm having a certain emotion, instead of it schlepping me down a particular path which may end up in the abyss or may end up in a ditch, I allow it to pass through me and see what I can learn from it. What should my response be? How can I grow from it? What is it teaching me? What is it telling me? So when I'm rooted in Hashem Echad, in my own Achdus, in my own oneness, then all the parts of me and all the parts that I'm encountering and all the parts that I'm experiencing can become part of that oneness. I know this may be a little bit of an abstract answer, but I think there's truth to it.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Before we get back to this week's episode, I want to tell you about our other Mishnah Berurah, an incredible Hebrew English Mishnah Berurah that changed the world. For any of you who do Halacha Yom Yitzhu, you're soon starting Hilchos Shabbos. Check out our Mishnah Berurah for Hilchos Shabbos. They have the whole set on the whole Mishnah Berurah and Hilchos Shabbos with incredible notes. They have questions and answers in the back. They have summaries. It'll be a real game changer. If you want to look at books, or you can visit the website, r-lm.org.
What does Jewish and joyful mean to you?
Jewish and joyful means what the Pasuk says in Tehillim, and we say it every morning in the beginning of Shachris, Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha, serve Hashem with joy. When do we serve Hashem? According to Yiddishkeit, when do we serve Hashem? And the answer is 24 hours a day, seven days a week. Avodas Hashem is not when I'm davening only, or when I'm learning, or when I'm doing a mitzvah. Of course, that's Avodas Hashem. Avodas Hashem is, as the Pasuk says in Mishlei, B'chol drachecha de'ehu. In all your ways, you should know him. Know him, das, means connect to him. So Avodas Hashem is 24-7. How can that be simcha? Why should I do it with joy? It's a burden. It's such a burden. Mincha, Maariv, Shachris, learning, this mitzvah, that mitzvah, it's enough. Now I have to serve you 24-7. The answer is the exact opposite. Avodas Hashem doesn't mean you're giving energy. It means you're taking energy. You're receiving energy. The Pasuk says in Tehillim, we say it also in the morning, Oiz v'chedva b'mkaymoy. In his space, there's confidence and joy. Plugging into the space of Hashem, plugging in ourselves as Hashem, means plugging into the source of all confidence and to the source of all joy.
It's beautiful. Thank you.
If I may ask, what was the most stressful time of your career? How do you get through it? And in general, how do we all become more Jewish and joyful Jews?
Talking about the stressful times of my career, I don't know, I have to think. My career can often get...
I hope this is not stressful right now, you know?
No, it's not stressful. It's actually a very beautiful question. I can't identify right now the most stressful moment in my career. My career often could come with a lot of stress.
Right.
It took me a long time, and it took me inner work to figure out how to navigate things, and it's still a work in progress. I'm still trying to learn and discover things every day. A major part of, I think, dealing with stress, at least for me, is really understanding who I am, and that is I'm a channel. My greatest truth is that I'm a channel for Hashem's light at every single moment. If I'm showing up to do something in order to get my ego validated, in order to feel good, in order to get compliments, in order to make money, just to make money or get compliments or get validation or be a celebrity or get honor or whatever. I'm trying to feed my ego, then things can get very, very stressful. When I can be a channel, I can show up as a channel for Hashem in every moment, then a lot of the stress is taken away. And the reason is, let's say a class, right? Let's have to give a lecture. If it's about my ego, I need perfection, and perfection never happens. So it's always stressful. And every little mistake I made, I'm going to kill myself and beat myself up for the next 3 days about that mistake. But if I could say, I'm a channel for Hashem, they're not coming to me. I didn't create this world. I don't own anybody's life. I can't give anybody even a little oxygen. I didn't create anything about this world. There's nothing I can give to anybody that's going to give them life. All the things were created by Hashem. So what's my job? My job is to be the channel that Hashem wants me to be at this moment. So I'm going to show up right now with the tools that I have right now and be that channel. So much of the stress is taken off. You get it? Now, it's easy to preach, but to feel that way in my body, to feel that way in my nervous system, to feel that way in a visceral way, that is work. That is what I see as one of the main issues of Avodas Hashem. To really come to a place, Chassidus always uses the word bittul. Bittul means that my ego lets go. It lets go of having the need to control and allows me to be a channel. And those are the moments of bliss and deep happiness and deep joy and deep meaning.
Wow. Beautiful answer. Thank you. Who is the happiest person that you know?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. Who's the happiest person that I know? I don't know. I have to think about that. But you are reminding me of a story, very, very powerful story. For me, it's very powerful. That is that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, at whose feet I grew up, he became the Lubavitcher Rebbe in 1951, a year after the passing of his father-in-law, the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Rebbe Rayatz. And I once saw a letter written in 1952, somebody by the name of Reb Yitzchak Golden. Reb Yitzchak Golden was a very special Jew. He spread Yiddishkeit in the Soviet Union, and he was sent to Siberia. Really, really special man. Then he came to New York. He was the principal of a big girls' school, and he was a deep soul. And I saw that he wrote a letter to Hasidim in Europe about the new Lubavitcher Rebbe. And he described his personality, just one line that touched me. He wrote in Yiddish, Afreilecher zubrochener ish eleiki.
Wow.
A joyous and broken man of God. I thought it was such a powerful description. Afreilecher, because if you're a Jew, there's a simcha. But a zubrochener, because if you're a Jew, your heartbeat, experiences the pain of Golos and the pain of the world and the pain of the Shechina, the pain of every soul. So there's a tzebrachenkeit, there's a sense of brokenness, there's this pain. I just thought that description, Afreilecher tzebrachener ish eleiki, was very powerful.
So back to the question, does Rav have in mind any specific person?
I don't remember.
Usually there's someone that comes to one's mind right away.
Yeah, I don't remember somebody particularly I think about. I'm sorry.
It's okay. Yeah.
Maybe I see too much pain. Children.
Yeah.
I love to see children giggling and playing and happy. Yeah. Life with innocence. And I want to jump right into the sandbox and play with them.
So I asked Rav Gav the question from Eretz Yisrael, Rav Gav.
Yeah.
So he said that is one of his son, like his young sons are the happiest person he knows because of just the innocence of life. He's always always happy.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. So now why there's so many people that are sad, depressed, and it's like never before, especially in our generation, and unfortunately it's coming more than ever. So many people walking around down and glum. So what could be the reason for this, and what could be a possible solution?
Wow. That's a powerful question. And that is, I would say one thing. Actually, my wife shared this with me today, a few minutes before this podcast. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciated it. She said, you know, we see that the present war between Israel and its sworn enemies, the Hamas, Yimach Shalom, is being fought. A lot of it is being fought in tunnels. Mm-hmm. Mamash in tunnels. Which makes it so unique and so unbelievable and so challenging and so difficult and so dangerous, because Hamas took the billions of dollars that were given to them and they built an incredibly impressive underground network, an infrastructure of terror that is subterranean and therefore so inaccessible. I mean, just incredible, incredible what happened with these billions of dollars. And Hamas and Iran's useful idiots are busy condemning Israel after squandering billions of dollars to be able to help murder innocent people, Arabs and Jews. So, you know, the Baal Shem Tov says everything is a lesson, and everything in the physical world comes from the spiritual world. Mm-hmm. And my wife shared with me that maybe one of the big elements of Avodas Hashem today is to go into our own tunnels. The Maharal speaks about the tunnels that exist in every soul. The Gemara says that Hashem made a tunnel for Menashe to be able to reach him. The tunnels are the subterranean parts in our system that are not at the surface. And what that means is really to be able to go into our own pnimius and identify the wounds, the coping mechanisms that we developed over the years from youth, and operating from that place. And often causes us to live such restrictive lives, such sad lives, such fearful lives, such stressful lives, such anxious lives. And really go into those tunnels and get rid of the terrorists in those tunnels. And what I mean by that is, I don't mean that Hamas lives in your heart, Chas v'Shalom.
Yes.
What I mean is to be able to identify the dark secrets and the darkness in our tunnels. And then we can also identify the infinite love in our tunnels. And I think that may be what part of our calling today. And it's a new avoda for many of us. Many of us don't have the skills or the mechanism or the wisdom or the humility to be able to go to those places. So we need to support each other. But I don't think there are shortcuts today.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for this chus.
Okay, so if you're still listening now, please like, follow, subscribe, and share this with friends and family. Baruch Hashem, we're having some more incredible guest content, interviews, episodes, clips, so please follow and subscribe for more. Podcast is available on all streaming platforms. Make sure to check out Parsha Knowledge. You get it every week for your Shabbos table. Email parshanknowledge@gmail.com, visit parshanknowledge.com, and check out our Ayla Mishnah Berurah, the Hebrew English Mishnah Berurah, a local bookstore, or visit the website r-elam.org. For more information, please see the show notes. To sponsor an episode and reach thousands of people, please call 646-397-2320 or email us at joyful@gmail.com. Thank you for listening and have an amazing day.
Joyful, that's what you need to be a happy kid. Joyous and joyful, Jewish and joyous. That's it. Those are the ingredients.